Hello and welcome to Stairway to ATJ, the CBA podcast that deals with all things access to justice.
We see access to justice as encompassing all efforts to provide people the opportunity to use the justice system when they are in need of a legal remedy.
I am Anthony Pereira, a pro bono coordinator for Metro Volunteer Lawyers, the pro bono arm of the Denver Bar Association.
And I'm Nia Kotnik, the Access to Justice Program Manager for the Colorado Bar Association.
Today, we're going to be talking about consumer bankruptcy. And it's hard to separate money from access, especially access to justice. This topic clearly deals with money, or at least money owed.
And a person's debt can impact every aspect of their life. We're going to learn the nuts and bolts of consumer bankruptcy, explore how people find themselves in situations where they need to file for bankruptcy, and we will discuss different approaches to solving the access to justice issues associated with consumer debt.
This episode of Stairway to ATJ will be a bit different as we have just one guest, but don't worry, we still have our pro bono corner. This episode features Yvonne Esparza from MVL, and the bulk of this episode will be an interview with Matt Skeen from CBA's Bankruptcy Clinic.
First, let's take a listen to the Pro Bono Corner. The Pro Bono Corner gives you a chance to hear about pro bono opportunities and programs addressing access to justice issues from every corner of the state. If you would like to be featured or know of a program that should be featured, email us at atjpodcast@cobar.org.
In this Pro Bono Corner, we have with us Yvonne Esparza. She is the Legal Service Coordinator for MVL. Yvonne, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hello. Well, first and foremost, thank you for having me. I've been in this position for the last 2.5 years, and I love it because we get to help individuals in true need. As Anthony mentioned, I am the Referral Program Coordinator for Metro Volunteer Lawyers, and it's my job and privilege to recruit and coordinate volunteer attorneys in the Denver metro area to assist people who are going through difficult times with money and obviously cannot afford legal services.
Yvonne, can you tell us a little bit more? What is the role that the volunteers play in this program?
Sure, Mia. So our volunteer attorneys will meet with our applicants to discuss their case in more detail. And if they think that they can represent our applicants through a Chapter 7, they will represent them on a full pro bono basis. Our applicants are responsible for their $335 filing fee to the bankruptcy court and any nominal fees associated with their case. They do not pay for the volunteer's time, but, you know, we do make them aware that, you know, they are responsible for those additional fees that they may incur. Our process is very straightforward. We receive all of our cases from Colorado Legal Services. And once I receive the Chapter 7s, I determine if they're suitable for a referral to a volunteer attorney. And once I go through my checklist of checking financials, assets, conflict checks, then I will locate a volunteer attorney to help us assist this applicant with their Chapter 7.
So you mentioned Chapter 7 bankruptcy. What other areas of law does the referral program handle?
Well, our referral program handles an array of civil legal issues. Our biggest need is in family law, and our second biggest need is in Chapter 7 bankruptcies. We only assist with Chapter 7, and aside from that, we also do Social Security income, Social Security disability, landlord-tenant issues, elder law, probate, guardianship and conservatorship matters, consumer issues as well.
Getting into some of the nitty-gritty details, what counties does your program serve? And do you have income qualifiers for people seeking your services?
Yes, Mia. So to answer your first question, we serve the Adams-Broomfield, Douglas-Elbert counties, and we also do Jefferson, Denver. Who am I missing, Anthony?
I actually think you got them all. The second part is income qualifications.
Income qualifications, people have to be at or below 200% of the federal poverty guidelines for us to accept them into our pro bono program. We do this by checking their gross monthly income, and we look to see what types of assets that they have.
Can you share with us a recent success story that you've had?
It's difficult to pinpoint one specific success story because we've had so many throughout the referral program with Chapter 7 bankruptcies. Almost every, if not all of them, have come back saying that they have received their discharge, which I think is incredible because, you know, you receive a case file and this person is drowning in debt. and to receive a notification from the volunteer attorney about 6 months later saying that this person's debt was fully discharged is, I think that is a beautiful success. And it seems 100%. To be, it seems to be happening with all of our Chapter 7 referrals that we send out to volunteers in the community. We have a wonderful panel of amazing volunteers that are very dedicated to helping our applicants in these situations. So I would say all of our Chapter 7 bankruptcies have been success stories thus far.
That's incredible. So if any of our listeners want to get involved and join that volunteer panel, how can they do that?
So first, they can email me directly. So iasparsa@denbar.org is my email address. They can also go on to our website at denbar.org/MBL. Click on the volunteer button. Once they click on the volunteer button, it'll take them to a page where it gives them information about all of our programs and the link to the sign up volunteer form. And once they click on that and fill that out, we will reach out to them immediately to see if we can set them up with a case. Other ways that our volunteers can get involved if they're not able to take on a full referral case at the time is to offer mentoring assistance to newer volunteers in this area. I always say word of mouth helps. So, letting people know that, we're an organization that's committed to bridging the gap in access to justice and helping people that really need it goes a long way. And, just spread the word.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time, Yvonne. We really appreciate you coming on with us.
Thank you, guys. It was my pleasure.
Today's interview will feature a guest who runs a bankruptcy clinic for the Colorado Bar Association. This is part of their goal to promote access to justice. The need for such a program exemplifies the interconnection between access to justice and bankruptcy law.
We are excited to be speaking with an experienced bankruptcy attorney who can not only discuss the access to justice issues he sees in his private practice, but he can also share the issues he sees come up in the CBA's pro se bankruptcy clinic. Matt Skeen Jr. participated in the Rotary Youth Exchange Program and lived in Santiago, Chile for a year, where he learned to speak fluent Spanish. This led him to earn a Bachelor's of Arts in Spanish and a Bachelor's of Science in Journalism at the University of Colorado Boulder, where he graduated cum laude. He did not stay here long, however, as he moved to Europe, where he taught English as a second language and became fluent in German. In 2010, Matt returned to the University of Colorado and earned his JD. He worked with Judge Timothy Timovic on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals and clerked for Judge Dennis A. Graham on the Colorado Court of Appeals. So I know that you work at Skeen & Skeen, a true family practice. Can you tell us about your work with your family?
Well, thanks for having me. I am really excited to talk to you guys today. My dad, he went to the same law school I did. He graduated from CU back in 1975 and went to work for Loaf and Barnhill after clerking for a judge on the 10th Circuit. But then he didn't really like big firm life and decided to strike out on his own and got into bankruptcy. He practiced under the Bankruptcy Act before it was converted to the Bankruptcy Code back in 1978. And my mom went to law school and she became a Chapter 7 bankruptcy trustee and sat on the panel for many years. After college, I kind of resisted for a while, but my brother, Ben, went to law school before I did. And then he started practicing with my dad and it looked like they were having so much fun that then I decided that I would do it too. So
great.
Yeah.
You're also working in the CBA's new pro se bankruptcy clinic. Can you describe the program and tell us about the work you're doing there?
The pro se bankruptcy clinic is kind of an offshoot of the federal pro se clinic, which is something that the CBA started, I think, about 2 years ago. And it's funded by fees paid by federal practitioners. And, a lot of those people, I think about 30%, are bankruptcy lawyers. So the bankruptcy court, they wanted in on the action. They thought that that would be a very useful service because you get a lot of pro se people in bankruptcy court, and a lot of times it's very difficult for them. So essentially what the clinic does is it provides people access to an attorney, right now just me, but hopefully soon volunteers as well, to just address some of the very complicated questions that can come up in a bankruptcy case. And we offer about an hour appointment. Right now it's remote, We're hoping to put a physical space in the bankruptcy court at some point. It's only been open for a couple months, but we're really gotten off the ground and handling a lot of calls.
Well, then it's definitely hard to get programs up and running. One of the questions that we like to ask all of our guests, and it's kind of a philosophical question, if you will. So in a sentence or two, what does access to justice mean to you?
It's providing a door into the justice system that we have. Our justice system is very good for a lot of reasons. And, you know, it's kind of in many ways a model for much of the world. However, it's not perfect. And one of the problems is that for the average Joe, it can be almost inaccessible. I mean, that's why attorneys exist. And that's how we make our living, is by helping people with these legal problems. But if you can't afford an attorney, you will have a lot of difficulty trying to do whatever you're trying to do through the courts or through, I mean, any number of legal issues that arise in a normal person's life.
I like the idea of the door being the access to justice. So I know I don't know much about bankruptcy law, and I'm assuming some of our listeners don't as well. So can you just kind of briefly lay out the types of bankruptcy and who could file under which chapter?
You know, in the bankruptcy context, I would say that access to justice is largely a matter of access to information, access to factual information, and not, you know, rumors and what you've heard from your friend who did it 7 years ago. Bankruptcy, what it is it is a way to get debt relief when your debts are unmanageable. In the old days, people got thrown in jail for having debt. And that was pretty dumb because it didn't really help anybody. You know, the creditor didn't get paid and the debtor couldn't make any money because he was sitting in debtor's prison. So they had to come up with a better solution than that. And so the bankruptcy code was formulated over the centuries this country has been in existence. And what it does is its goal is to allow the honest debtor a fresh start, a way to wipe the ledger clean and start over. You know, the policy principles behind it are, first of all, let people live a life that is not encumbered by crushing debt. And at the same time, to encourage people to take economic risks, to start businesses, and to be allowed to fail and start over. So basically, for an individual, and that's what the clinic does, it only serves individuals. You've got essentially two different types of bankruptcy. You've got Chapter 7 and Chapter 13.
What are the differences kind of between Chapter 7 and Chapter 13?
Chapter 7 is a liquidation. And so what you do is you list all of your assets and all of your debts, and when you file your petition, you're assigned to a bankruptcy trustee, and a bankruptcy estate is created. And the trustee is in charge of the estate, and he acts as a fiduciary for creditors. After you file, you go to a meeting of creditors, and the trustee asks you questions, and he looks at your schedules. And what he is trying to do is find out if there's any assets that you have that can come into the estate that can be sold and used to pay pro rata any creditor that files a claim in your case. Chapter 13 is much different. In Chapter 13, the debtor creates a plan that lasts over 3 or 5 years, depending on what they're qualified for. And they pay 100% of their disposable income into the plan over 3 or 5 years. And those payments are then distributed to creditors. Now, typically, people who want to get debt relief, for them, 7 is the best option. It's faster, it's cheaper, and it's much more likely to succeed. Chapter 13s often fail because debtors' situations change and they miss plan payments, or there's a lot of ways that a Chapter 13 can go wrong.
Well, thank you for giving us an overview of bankruptcy. And you were discussing a little bit how historically people who you know, had debt were sent to debtor's prison, but we know that people with debt are not criminals. Can you kind of talk to us about some of the circumstances that might lead a person to file for bankruptcy?
A lot of the debt that I see come through is credit card debt. A lot of people get in trouble with credit cards, and they, you know, they get into a rough patch and they live off credit cards, and all of a sudden, you know, they're not paying them off and they're accruing interest. Then they stop paying the credit card and it gets turned over to an attorney who tries to get a judgment against them. When somebody gets served with papers saying you have to go to court on this debt, that's a lot of times the triggering action where people say, oh boy, I got to figure out what to do. Medical debt is something that in this country gives people a lot of problems. If they had some kind of catastrophic illness and weren't insured, and those that's dischargeable. One of the main debt burdens that we have in this country is student loan debt, which is actually not dischargeable in bankruptcy. I think if they ever changed that rule, we would see a tidal wave of filings. Sometimes people's business fails. And anytime you borrow a bunch of money for a business, you're usually going to be personally liable on those loans. Or, you know, if you have a commercial lease where you've agreed to rent a restaurant space for 5 years or something like that, and you default on the lease, you can get a nasty landlord going after you personally for all of that defaulted lease payments going forward for 3 years or something like that. When people's business fails and they have that business debt that they're personally liable for, a lot of times those are people who discharge massive amounts of money through bankruptcy.
So this podcast tries to focus as much as on access to justice as possible. So what are some of the, in your eyes, some of the biggest access to justice issues facing debtors looking at bankruptcy?
Well, like I mentioned, I think access to information is a huge problem. The bankruptcy code is very complex, and it gives trustees extraordinary powers to pursue assets to try to get them into the estate. For example, there is something called a preference. One of the ideas of bankruptcy is that instead of everyone trying to be the first one to get to the courthouse to get the judgment, to get the money before it's gone, everybody comes to the court at the same time, and it's an orderly process, and they file a claim, and they all get treated equally. Because of this, you're not supposed to have preferential creditors. So for example, if you borrowed $5,000 from your father-in-law, most likely would much rather pay him back than Capital One. One of the things that you're not allowed to do is pay your preferential creditors back. And if they're family, it's a year look back period. And if you do pay your father-in-law back $5,000 and you file bankruptcy, the trustee can then go to the father-in-law, who's obviously already spent the money a year ago, and tell him to pay $5,000 into the bankruptcy estate. So there are all kinds of consequences that happen when you file bankruptcy. And if you're not aware of these laws, you can really get hurt.
It certainly makes Thanksgivings awkward, I can tell.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, once you file Chapter 7, you turn over a lot of power. And what happens after that is not necessarily completely in your hands. You can't just dismiss a Chapter 7 if you made a mistake. You can get stuck in one. And, you know, for a judge to approve the dismissal of a Chapter 7, the question is it in the best interests of creditors, not your best interests? If you did some kind of fancy estate planning to avoid having your house go through probate and you transferred your whole house to your kids, you know, in title only, you're going to have to explain to the trustee why you still qualify for a homestead exemption.
I have the pleasure of working with you in the clinic, and I've been learning a lot. One of the things that I found really surprising about bankruptcy is that it actually isn't the right solution for everyone. And in fact, people without assets or, you know, folks who we might consider kind of the poorest people out there often don't have a lot to gain from filing for bankruptcy. So can you kind of talk about bankruptcy really can help. And maybe those folks who, you know, filing for bankruptcy isn't going to do much to change their situation.
If you have nothing, there's not a whole lot that a creditor can do about it. They can't get a lien on anything. If you're unemployed, there's no wages to garnish. If you got nothing in your bank account, there's no bank account to garnish. You know, if you don't really don't have anything, then there's not much a creditor can do. What I usually tell people is that the best time to file is when you've hit rock bottom and you're starting to work your way back up and you're running into obstacles because you get that job and it pays fairly well. And all of a sudden, a creditor is getting 25% of your paycheck, or you're about to get a judgment against you. And, you know, you don't want them to be able to get a lien on the house that you just purchased, for example. So it's really good for people who are kind of on the mend. A lot of people are just not comfortable having a lot of debt, and it really bothers them. And when creditors call or send letters, it makes them feel terrible and stressed out and anxious. You know, so a lot of times that can be the obstacle.
Yeah.
A lot of people worry that if they file bankruptcy, they'll have to, you know, they'll lose everything. Well, that's not entirely true. I've mentioned a couple times this idea of exemptions. Every state has its own exemption laws. The law says that creditors are not allowed to take certain things away from you. So if you have a vehicle and it's worth less than $7,500, you can keep your vehicle. You can keep two of them if they fall under that value. Most people don't have any equity in their cars. They either the car's worth almost nothing or they owe on more than it's worth. The big one in Colorado that's causing people lots of trouble is the homestead exemption. You're allowed to keep up to $75,000 of equity in your house. Well, if you've lived in Colorado for over 5 years, probably you've got more than $75,000 of equity in your house. And if you do, and you file Chapter 7, then the trustee is allowed to sell your house and give you the $75,000 and take whatever's left to pay creditors. And that's something that a lot of people can't do. And that's another reason why a lot of people end up filing Chapter 13s instead of Chapter 7s, is to protect their houses.
So there are two sides to every story. So for example, there are those that borrow money and there are those that loan money. So I don't know if you can take a moment to discuss like creditors. While often creditors are big businesses or banks, entities along those lines, you mentioned like the father-in-law. So can you tell us how like an individual might become a creditor and what access to justice issues they might face?
Any kind of personal loans that you make are kind of risky. I mean, people who loan somebody money and get a promise that they'll pay them back and then they don't. You know, a lot of times you get creditors who are in like corporate Chapter 11s who have, you know, small businesses and vendors who have provided goods and services and are waiting to get paid. And then all of a sudden they get a letter saying that they're not going to get paid on that invoice and file a claim and see how much you get.
What about things like car accidents or other ways? Are there any other ways that you can come?
Oh, you know, divorce, you know, you get divorced and there's a settlement agreement. Luckily, child support and domestic support obligations are essentially untouchable. You can't discharge them, and they're priority claims that get paid first if there's any arrearages or anything like that. But a lot of divorced people, they'll have, you know, they'll be co-debtors on something, and then all of a sudden one of them is getting out of it through bankruptcy and is just going to leave all of the debt on the person who's not filing. A lot of times, I mean, with things like car accidents, I mean, restitution payments, those are usually non-dischargeable. So, you know, typically you can still pursue restitution. You know, let's say you hired a construction firm to do, you know, put an addition on your house and they took your roof off and then never did anything. And then it snowed and your house is basically destroyed and you sue them. And you get a judgment for all the damage that they did to your house, and then they file bankruptcy.
Fun stories.
So circling back to the start of the conversation, when you told us a little bit about the Pro Se Bankruptcy Clinic, we've talked a little bit about bankruptcy in general, and I think that you mentioned access to information is one of the major access to justice issues you see. So can you talk about how the clinic you're leading is addressing that access to justice issue.
Well, I'm very happy when we get calls from people who are thinking about filing bankruptcy, because then I can answer all kinds of questions and I can tell them if it's the right thing to do. And I can tell them, this is the stuff you're going to have to disclose. And I can tell them, these are the things that might be problematic or that the trustee will have questions about. You know, don't file it, it'll be a disaster. And so those are the people I feel I can help the most. The sad part is the people who have already filed and they thought that they could just do it themselves and they didn't get the right advice. And all of a sudden, a problem arises and they're stuck. Those are really hard cases, and there's not a whole lot that I can do at that point other than explain what is happening to them and why. But even that, I think, provides some comfort, you know, that you're just not sitting there bewildered and just, you know, uncomprehending of why the trustee is going to sell your house.
And just to follow up, are you aware of other programs either in Colorado or across the nation that are also trying to address some of these issues?
The Faculty of Federal Advocates does a lot of good work. I've done work for them before. They have a pro bono program where they place pro bono attorneys with people who are being sued under 523 or 727. 523 is the provision of the bankruptcy code that says that certain debts are non-dischargeable. So for example, if a creditor can prove that you fraudulently induced him to lend him money and can show that there was actual fraud, they can prevent that debt from being discharged. Willful and malicious injury is another one. So the 727 is an action to deny the debtor a discharge of any of his debts. They call that's sort of like the death sentence in bankruptcy, is if you get denied your discharge, you've gone through this whole thing and all of your debts are still with you. You have to have committed some kind of bad act during your bankruptcy. So you lied on your schedules or attempted to conceal assets or lied under oath at your meeting of creditors, things like that.
So Matt, I was hoping that you could kind of share some success stories with us. We'd like to end on positive notes. I would love one from the clinic, but private practice as well. I don't think it's too much to ask for both.
Well, let's start with one from private practice. Sometimes a question arises as to what if a creditor didn't get notice of the bankruptcy? So I had a client come to see me. She was deaf. She went with her boyfriend to a hearing and there was not a sign language interpreter. So she just had to basically depend on what her boyfriend told her happened at the hearing. And he told her that nothing happened. When in actuality, a judgment had entered against both of them from their former landlady, and she didn't know about it. So she filed bankruptcy, she got her discharge, and then a year or two after that, the landlady tracked her down and got a garnishment on her wages at the coffee shop. And she said, I filed bankruptcy. And the landlady said, well, I didn't get notice, so that means that your debt didn't get discharged. She went to the court where the garnishment was issued up in Summit County, explained it to the judge, and the judge believed the landlady, but the judge was wrong. And so I had to, you know, appeal his decision up to the Court of Appeals, and I had to sue the landlady for violation of the discharge injunction. Eventually, she backed down. She was trying to collect a debt that had been discharged that this poor lady didn't even know about, and it was just causing her all kinds of trouble, and I got rid of her. So that was good. I'm trying to think of success stories from the clinic. One of the great things about the clinic for me is that it's extremely limited scope. And so I don't really stick with these cases from beginning to end. For example, I had a guy who was asking me about reopening his case because he wanted to file an adversary proceeding to determine whether a debt had been actually discharged or not. Usually to reopen your case, you have to pay like $250. but I looked into it. And if the debtor is reopening his own case to try to determine whether or not a debt has actually been discharged, the filing fee doesn't apply. So I saved that guy $250.
There you go.
Yeah. That was a success.
So Matt, I've heard you talk about shame before, and that a lot of creditors kind of come to the bankruptcy process with shame. Can you talk about that and how that can impact their approach to the case?
Yeah. Debtors often feel terrible about their situation. And I think that that is something that's kind of cultural. You would be amazed at how many people are just terrified about their credit score. You know, that's what they're most worried about with filing bankruptcy is, well, will it hurt my credit score? And I think a lot of people kind of look at that number as kind of a measure of worth in some ways. And that number will go down and they feel reflects badly upon who they are as a person. I try to tell them not to worry about it, but people worry about it. You know, you talk to people and they say, oh, I never thought I would be here. I always paid my bills on time. I used to make, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and I just can't believe where I found myself, you know. And they try to, you know, convince you that they're not a bad person. And it's very sad. And, you know, that's one of the things that I try my hardest to do, is to just try to reassure them that they're not bad people, that terrible things happen in life. And, you know, that this is just something that has been put in place for this exact situation, so that you can get a new start and try again. You know, if you fail again, you can file another bankruptcy in 8 years, but only one every 8 years.
That's also a very good success story, is helping people with their shame that they have around this.
Well, I think that lawyers, you really have to be a humble person, I think, to be a really good lawyer who has good relationships with their clients and can really empathize and try to help the best they can. And I don't think all lawyers are humble. And I think that humbleness is something that we should strive for as a profession.
I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you, Matt, for joining us today.
Yeah.
It was lovely having this conversation.
This is my pleasure. Thank you for putting it on.
We at Stairway to ATJ would like to thank Yvonne Esparza, featured in our Pro Bono Corner, as well as Matt Skeen Jr., who joined us for our interview today. Also, thank you to our listeners. This episode of Stairway to ATJ, as well as the other CBA podcasts, including The Modern Law Revolution, Our Voices, and Getting Legal With It. If you have an ATJ subject that you would like us to cover here on the show, please feel free to email us at atjpodcast@cobar.org. I'm Anthony Pereira. Stay healthy and be good to each other.
And I'm Mia Kotnik. Keep climbing, stay curious, and come volunteer with us.